My name is Paul Weber, and I am really pleased to be able to welcome you to the teleclass, Positive Deviance, Liberating the Secret Change Agents in Your Hospital to Prevent Healthcare-Acquired Infections. I have in my hand a book called The Power of Positive Deviance by Richard Pascal, Jerry Sternin, and Monique Sternin. Now, this is probably the quintessential overview of positive deviance. It's and written by those who first described it and who first championed it. It is a fascinating book, and I would encourage all of you to get a copy of it. And in the acknowledgments, there are four people who are singled out for special thanks. One of those is Dr. John Lloyd, who, and I'm reading from the book here, who in addition to pioneering the application of PD to healthcare, has been a steadfast partner in bringing this work to fruition. Dr. Lloyd is a senior associate at the Positive Deviance Initiative and a senior clinical advisor at the Plexus Institute. He was trained as a thoracic and vascular surgeon. He has been director of the surgical residency program at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. He was the chairman of their Department of Surgery for more than a decade. He has served as project coordinator for the CDC and VA to work on a community-wide effort to eliminate endemic MRSA. And it was out of this work that he began to see positive deviance as a cultural approach to fight healthcare-acquired infections. Dr. Lloyd is coaching several hospitals in the U.S. and Canada on using positive deviance, and it is indeed a great honor to have him with us today. So from Tufts University and the Plexus Institute, I am delighted to present Dr. John Lloyd. John.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's a real pleasure to join the teleclass. I'd like to interrupt this class on positive deviance and MRSA prevention with some breaking news. As many of you know, the CDC reported good news in the Journal of the American Medical Association yesterday. The CDC's Emerging Infections Program, Active Bacterial Core, or ABC, surveillance system has documented a continuous decline in invasive MRSA infections in nine diverse geographic areas in the U.S. during a four-year period from 2005 through 2008. Over this period, they reported an estimated 9.4% annual decline in healthcare-acquired hospital-onset MRSA infections and a 5.7% annual decline in healthcare-associated community-onset MRSA infections. Both of these account for about over 80% of MRSA infections. The remainder is of these infections are due to community-acquired MRSA. These reductions in hospital-acquired MRSA infections are largely due to decreases in MRSA bloodstream infections in ICU patients with central venous catheters. A brief editorial comment is in order before we commence with the teleclass. The CDC's ABC study was based on clinical microlab data in nine geographic areas in the U.S., with a total population of around 15 million. Acute care hospitals participating in this study are collaborating with the CDC in a serious effort to prevent MRSA healthcare-acquired infections. These regions reported approximately 18,000 invasive MRSA infections from 2005 to 2008. Based on the CDC's previous study in JAMA in 2007, which reported a mortality rate of 20% in those with invasive MRSA infections, there were approximately 3,500 deaths in this current four-year study. The question we need to ask ourselves is, what about the remaining 285 million people who are not covered by this study, who live in areas where efforts to quell the MRSA epidemic described by the CDC just 3 years ago may not be as intense as the nine study areas? The CDC mentioned sporadic reports of dramatic reductions in MRSA healthcare-acquired infections in individual hospitals, some of which are outside the population area in their study. Hospitals participating in a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation-funded collaborative from 2006 through 2008 to prevent these infections are among those non-CDC ABC study hospitals that have achieved dramatic and relentless reductions in MRSA infections. I'll be talking about how this got started in one hospital and has subsequently spread to many. Over the next 55 minutes, we will consider why a steeply hierarchical healthcare system looked to positive deviance to solve its MRSA infection problem, how a leader created conditions that enabled healthcare workers to discover that they have the solutions and to act on them, and how the stunning results they achieved inspired other hospitals to do likewise. First, I have a confession to make. I am not an infectious disease doctor. I'm a surgeon, as Paul mentioned, and the only credential that justifies my speaking about HAIs is the fact that I am a reformed MRSA transmitter. Yes, like many of my colleagues, I unwittingly spread my share of germs to patients. That is, until I knew better. How that change happened is what I'd like to share with you. This was one of the most important experiences in my 40-year career as a general and vascular surgeon. So let's go to the next slide and look at the roadmap of things we'll be covering. First, we'll talk about the first application of positive deviance focused on childhood malnutrition in Vietnam, and then some of the salient features of PD that attracted us. We'll talk about the current data on healthcare-acquired infections, especially MRSA. We'll talk about how PD was applied to healthcare, first at the VA hospital in Pittsburgh and then several others, and then talk about the results they achieved. We always begin a discussion about positive deviance with a story about Nasir ud-Din, the famous Sufi mystic. And in this story, Nasir ud-Din is a renowned smuggler of contraband between the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Each day, Nasir ud-Din comes with his caravan of donkeys loaded with bales of hay. And each day he comes up to the same customs station at the border, and the same customs official greets him. He examines and frisks Nasir ud-Din, then goes to the donkeys, examines the hay. Sometimes he burns the hay. The customs official can never find out what it is that Nasir ud-Din is smuggling. This goes on year after year. All the while, Nasir ud-Din is getting richer and richer, and the poor customs official is getting more and more frustrated. Finally, after many years, the two men are old enough to retire, and they encounter each other on a mountain pass. The customs official recognizes Nasir ud-Din immediately and says, "Nasir ud-Din, now that we are both old and I can no longer harm you, you must tell me, what was it during all those years that you were smuggling?" To which Nasir ud-Din shrugged his shoulders, looked at the customs official, and said, "Donkeys." Well, that's really the essence of positive deviance. That is, that the solution to many seemingly intractable problems are hidden in plain sight right before our eyes. The concept of positive deviance was first described by a nutritionist at the Friedman School of Nutrition at Tufts University. Her name is Marion Seitlin, and she had observed in many of the most impoverished villages in the Third World that there were families who had well-nourished kids. This was documented. It was a concept, and it was associated with the idea that these solutions might be a source of encouragement and progress in the communities where the solutions existed. It's based on the premise that in every community, there are certain people or groups of people whose uncommon behaviors enable them to come up with better solutions than their neighbors. PD, the process, provides a network that enables a community to self-discover these solutions and amplify them in such a way that more members of the community can adopt the same successful behaviors. Well, this was first, this concept was first applied by Jerry and Monique Sternen, who represented Save the Children Federation in Southeast Asia in the early 90s. The Vietnamese government, during the U.S. embargo on Vietnam, invited the Sternens to come to Vietnam to solve their problem of childhood malnutrition. 80% of the children under the age of 5 were significantly malnourished. The Sternens were given 6 months to show measurable improvement in 4 villages. They realized that they couldn't use a typical field study approach, which they had done in the past, and they knew about Marion Seitlin's concept of positive deviance and decided that they would pilot this concept in these 4 villages. The first thing they did is begin to develop relationships with the leaders of the villages, the health aides, and the villagers, and discovered existing solutions, among which were growth charts on all of the children under the age of 5. They were a little outdated, so the Sternens requested, asked the villagers if they would be willing to remeasure and reweigh the kids and be sure that each family participate in generating this database so that the parents, grandparents, and siblings would bring the children, measure, weigh, record, and the end result of this was a database that provided growth charts with recent information on all of the children under the age of 5. The Sternens then asked the villagers to, or the health aides, to stratify the data based on economic status. The categories they came up with were poor, very poor, and very, very poor, to which the Sternens responded, are any of your very, very poor families, do any of your very, very poor families have kids that are well nourished? And they self-discovered that indeed they did have perhaps more than they were aware of once they looked at their data. At that point, the villagers were hell-bent on finding out what the secrets were. The Sternens also were tempted, although they resisted this quickly, to go back to their apartment in Hanoi, crunch out perfect data, interview the positive deviant families with the well-fed kids, and then come back like we do in healthcare in the U.S., beating our chests using a best practice approach, announcing that they had the solutions. This is what the positive deviant, this is what the successful families are doing, and this is what the rest of you should do. They resisted that temptation, and they worked with the community to design a method whereby the resource families who had the well-fed kids could meet with the other families and share their secrets. Prior to that, the villagers were represented by a group that interviewed members of the community to determine the current attitudes and practices regarding child feeding. They confirmed that rice was the staple. Kids were fed in the morning and in the evening when their parents returned from work. And if the child developed diarrhea, the feedings were stopped. That was the conventional wisdom and current approach. They then paired up and interviewed the families with the well-fed kids, the positive deviant families. And they found out that they were doing things, a few things significantly differently. Each morning before work, the parents would gather freshwater shrimps, crabs, and sweet potato greens. Inland, it was peanuts that was the protein source, and they added these to the rice. The conventional wisdom was that this is trash food and you don't feed it to your kids, but that's what the successful families were doing. They also engaged in practices that most families didn't, including hand hygiene, holding and nurturing the young children while they were feeding them. If the child developed diarrhea, they would double the feedings. So with this discovery, the representatives from the community decided to develop an action plan that would enable the families with the poorly fed kids to learn these strategies and behaviors. They got together, the resource families would get together with the learning families 5 days a week for 2 weeks in a row. They would have sort of a coffee klatch, talk, relate, cook, make the meals, feed the kids. The price of admission for the learning families wasn't rice, as you might imagine, but it was to go out each morning and gather their own constituents, their own shrimps, crabs, and greens. In other words, they were required to change their behavior, something that had never happened in attempts to solve this problem of child malnutrition. So with that as the price of admission, and with these 2 weeks of practice with the PD families, essentially all of the learning families saw a few ounces of weight gain in their child's cheeks. They knew that their child would now enjoy normal development, and the vast majority of them didn't turn their backs on the solutions that they were beginning to uncover and apply themselves. Those who did lapse back into their old behaviors would go back for 2 more weeks. Well, 6 months later, the officials came. They documented significant measurable improvement, specifically the malnutrition rates in these two villages, or in these four villages, had dropped from 80% to 20%. The Sternin's passports were renewed, and they were off and running for the next several years. This became the national approach to child malnutrition in Vietnam and several other countries. Well, the salient features of this approach are outlined in these five or six simple steps. What the Sternins did was enable the community to define the problem based on their own experience and based on their own database. They then were able to determine with the villagers that there were positive deviant families in their community who had figured out how to maintain a good state of nutrition in their family. They then went about discovering the specific behaviors and strategies used by the PD families. And then they created an action plan that enabled others in the community to adopt the same behaviors, all the while measuring their results, telling stories, and then these four villages became living universities for the remainder of the country for sharing their practices and strategies. The salient features of PD are, I think, best described by the bell curve. Most of our attention in healthcare is focused on the right-hand side, the negative outlier portion of a bell curve. We've developed several highly effective defect-based strategies, rapid cycle improvement, Lean Six Sigma, Toyota Production System, to identify problems and at this end of the spectrum and to prevent them. We pay very little attention to the positive outliers on a bell curve, the left-hand side of the bell curve, thinking that there must be something magical going on here. What the Sternins did is disarm or remove the myth that there's something magical going on in the positive side of the bell curve. They were able to discover very practical, specific strategies and behaviors that were immediately available and accessible to all members of the community, and then enable the community to create a strategy for amplifying those processes. The traditional approach to improvement in most industries is based on the idea of is based primarily on education. Enhance the knowledge base, this changes attitude, which in turn changes practice. PD flips this on its head. It emphasizes the primacy of action. It is easier to act your way to a new way of thinking, so that action leads to changes in attitudes, which in turn changes the knowledge base. This next slide, showing the wall, we're now on slide 9, and I'm sorry that I haven't been saying next slide. Slide 9 shows a wall with some graffiti on it. on the left-hand side and a bunch of people falling off the wall, and on the right-hand side there are people standing on each other's shoulders. Well, this illustrates that for many of our seemingly intractable problems, we wait for the root causes to be dealt with and then hope that that will then lead to the behavior change necessary to solve the problem. As stated, PD begins with things that are already working in the community in a collaborative effort, co-creating solutions, amplifying them, developing action plans for sharing these among members of the community. In Vietnam, the graffiti on the left-hand side would be illiteracy, poor hygiene, bad water, lack of sanitation, etc. And they actually had a bunch of experts come in prior to the Sternens, experts in these areas, investigating the problem, making their recommendations with uniform results, failure. There was no behavior change. What the Sternens did was enable the community to self-discover solutions that already existed and then devise a plan for amplifying them. So it really gets to the very important statement that the presence of positive deviance demonstrates that it is possible to find successful solutions today before all of the root causes are taken care of. Well, how does this relate to healthcare-acquired infections? Positive deviance was applied, by the Sternens initially to the problem of childhood malnutrition, and then subsequent to that, several other really tough social problems yielded to this approach, including female genital cutting in Egypt, girl trafficking, HIV/AIDS, maternal mortality, neonatal mortality in Pakistan, with remarkable success. How might this apply to the problem that's demonstrated on slide 10, showing just outlining the magnitude of the problem of healthcare-acquired infections in the U.S., approximately 2 million with close to 100,000 deaths at a very high cost to families and in terms of dollars. The next slide shows the Health and Human Services report of 2009, or the bottom line of that report. It was published in April of this year, and it documented the fact that healthcare-acquired infections have yet to plateau in this country. They continue to increase in prevalence. The next slide shows data from the Agency for Health Research and Quality from the early 90s, when there were 2,000 MRSA infections documented, through 2005, a year when there were 350,000 MRSA infections reported. And as the Health and Human Services report stated last year, total MRSA infections, superficial and invasive, throughout the country continue to rise in spite of this most recent study in the nine geographic areas by the CDC. The next slide summarizes the findings of the CDC's earlier report in JAMA in 2007. If your slide reads that one in five died, parentheses 200,000, please change that to 20,000. There's a 20% mortality in patients who develop an invasive MRSA infection, 87% of which are healthcare acquired. By that I mean a little bit more than 50% of them are patients who acquire these invasive infections, are colonized in a healthcare facility, but their infection manifests itself outside of healthcare in the community. Those are healthcare acquired community onset. A slightly lower percentage of healthcare-acquired infections manifest themselves in the hospital while the patient is still hospitalized. So the next slide shows the increasing incidence of colonization. There's been a 130% increase from 2001 to 2005, and this has undoubtedly continued over the past 5 years, going from 2.4 million U.S. citizens colonized in 2001 to 5.1 million. So this truly has been and continues to be a national epidemic worth this discussion and worth many more and a lot of action. This slide shows how complex MRSA prevention is. This actually shows the 568 steps to deliver Tylenol number 3 in a hospital from the doctor's pen, an order sheet, to the patient's mouth. And you can see how convoluted and fragmented most systems are in our healthcare world that we all work in. Well, if you think of the thousands of healthcare workers that touch patients, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times every day in our country, we can certainly appreciate how very complex this is. Well, let's get to, you know, what role could PD possibly play in preventing MRSA infections when the solution to the problem is so dumbfoundingly simple? Wash your hands before and after caring for a patient. Wear a gown and gloves when caring for somebody who has an MRSA infection or is colonized, and keep the environment clean. Well, we've seen that it turns out to be a little bit more complicated than that. Let me take you back to my environment in 2004 when I was working as a community coordinator for the VA hospital in Pittsburgh with CDC funding in southwestern Pennsylvania in a regional collaboration to prevent MRSA healthcare-acquired infections. For 4 years, a three-person infection control team at the VA had tried everything, hand hygiene campaigns, rapid cycle improvement. The hospital even hired a consultant trained at Toyota to help redesign the system to enhance precaution compliance. These methods achieved reductions in MRSA infections in a few nursing units, but they couldn't be sustained. Success didn't spread within the hospital or among the many hospitals that visited the VA in Pittsburgh to learn, and these methods were cost prohibitive. At this point, we met the first precondition for positive deviance. We were desperate, we had a serious problem, and the standard model had failed us. The chief medical officer, Dr. Rajiv Jain, and I read an article on the Sternin's work in Vietnam, their pioneering work in applying PD to the problem of child malnutrition. We were inspired by what we learned about PD. Go to the next slide, slide number 17. What we realized from the past experience is that healthcare-acquired infections aren't primarily a knowledge problem. We've known since Semmelweis, 163 years ago, about hand hygiene. Semmelweis actually applied contact isolation precautions with the supplies and equipment that they had available in 1847. We've known about active surveillance and resistant pathogens for at least 50 years. So healthcare-acquired infections due to resistant pathogens is not primarily a knowledge problem, and we also know that it's not primarily a technical problem. The other thing that we knew based on past experience is that traditional best practice industrial approaches and pay for performance and state mandates have had very little lasting effect on the prevalence of these infections. We knew that the time was ripe for a solution that matched the complexity and the nature of this challenge. The next slide, slide 18. Based on what we had read, we felt that PD might be a reasonable approach because this was a complex problem that required not only technical and knowledge solutions, but also behavior and social change. And the whole premise of PD stated that we could probably afford to do this because the solutions already existed in the hospital. Well, the next slide, where are the shrimps, crabs, and greens in healthcare? Where would we find, what would be the source of these solutions? we realized that with our small infection prevention team, we had an opportunity to dramatically expand that team. Lots of people are much smarter than just a few people, especially those that deal with the problem on a daily basis. The next slide shows a few examples of the people that seemed to be the likely suspects. Normally, they're the unlikely suspects for solving clinical problems, but suddenly they became places that we wanted to visit and the people we wanted to talk to. We ask ourselves, who could possibly know best how, when, and where transmissions might be taking place and how they would go about preventing them in their line of work? Who would know how the system really works and how to improve it? The next slide shows an iceberg with about 4% of it protruding out of the water. This shows this is commonly known as the iceberg of ignorance. I've chosen a more polite title, the awareness iceberg, and it shows that senior leadership knows about 4% of what's really going on in the front line. What the problems really are and how best to solve them are embedded deep under the water at the level of the frontline staff. So, next slide. Who then could possibly know better than the people that actually spread and transmit these resistant pathogens, the touchers, those who come in direct contact with patients and their immediate surroundings? The unlikely suspects were therefore the ones that began to loom, as I mentioned, as the likely people that would be the most knowledgeable and be the true gurus within the hospital. That did require some role change, because at the mid-management level, I and many others that were involved in this process were really sort of the designated problem solvers. But we knew that we didn't know the jobs of those who transmit the pathogens nearly as well as they did, nor could we figure out as well as they could how to prevent transmissions in their line of work. The next slide shows what PD does to that iceberg. It turns it upside down so that the leadership has the vision to go to the staff to support them in eliciting the solutions that already exist and roll the boulders out of the way, eliminate barriers so that they can act on their discoveries. So we ended up saying we've got a bunch of evidence-based precautions, and the next slide shows the so-called bundle of things that are evidence-based, washing hands before and after every patient contact. We decided to do active surveillance because we wanted to know what our reservoir, MRSA, was in the hospital. We also wanted to know what our transmission rates were. So at the VA, they culture every admission, every patient on admission, discharge, transfer, and even death. So the transmission rates are clearly understood, and they're easier to follow because they're more numerous than the infection rates. You can plot them out on a graph and more visibly in a more compelling way. And we know that about 30% of people who are colonized with MRSA will eventually develop an infection, either superficial or deep. Protective clothing from wearing PPEs when caring for somebody who is colonized or infected, and cleaning equipment, shared equipment, and also cleaning the environment. Those are essentially the SHEA guidelines, and we know that the SHEA guideline doesn't implement itself. The next slide shows the questions we then asked ourselves. How are we going to unleash the solutions from our touchers? What are we going to do once the transmission sites and causes have been exposed and solutions have been proposed by those who know best? And then what do we do to start today to address these issues? Feeling that positive deviance was worth piloting to address these issues, we picked up the telephone and we called the Sternens and asked if they might be able to help us out with this problem. We'd read their article. We were wondering. We told them a little bit about MRSA. And this was really the second precondition for positive deviance. We called the Sternens. We wanted We wanted to try PD. This was our first opt-in. We were a bit puzzled by Jerry Sternin's response. He told us that, well, the problem with PD is that it only works in practice. Actually, he was giving us another opportunity to opt in. We took it and invited Jerry and Monique to come to the hospital. Well, fast forward 4 months. Let's go to the slide number 30, define and determine. The Sternins came and talked to a large group of hospital leaders at the VA, not only leaders, but room cleaners, physicians and nurses, ministers, patient transporters. Everyone was represented who had contact with patients. They shared their experience. The Sternins shared their experience in Vietnam after we went over our own data. They talked about successfully pioneering positive deviance in the area of childhood malnutrition. Then they invited the staff to discuss whether it made sense to use PD to approach our MRSA problem. The Sternins then left. The staff stayed and discussed the opportunity and decided to give PD a try. At this point, Dr. Jane announced to the staff, "I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm confident that you and your colleagues will." Dr. Jane then invited those, next slide, who wanted to participate to meet with us the following morning to organize this effort. This leadership behavior of going to the workforce for solutions, fostering ownership, and removing barriers is a common thread that runs through every successful application of positive deviance. Next slide, that is labeled Discovery and Action Dialogue, shows what the next steps were. Like the Sternins in Vietnam, and with their coaching, we trained a group of people, catalysts, that would go to the staff in small groups, not as experts with solutions, but as catalysts with questions to tap into the knowledge of the workforce. These are the questions that were asked on the next slide. How do you know whether your patient has MRSA or carries the MRSA germ? In your own practice, what do you do to prevent spreading this pathogen to your patients? What are the barriers that prevent you from doing this all the time? And do you know anyone that's really good at overcoming these barriers? Or do you have any great ideas yourself that you think might be worth trying? What would it take to make, to actually act on these ideas or amplify things that are already working? And what seems to be possible now? Who should be at the table to talk about and work on an action plan and actually make this happen? And who wants to volunteer? As we saw with the initial community kickoff, with all the staff represented, about 30% of those who were at the kickoff volunteered to work on the problem, and each time we met with groups of frontline staff, about 30% of them volunteered. With each discussion, this next slide, Design and Do, gets into some of the stories. With each discussion, we ask for volunteers, as I mentioned, and we were off and running. I'd like to share a few stories about what happened. This slide, these stories explain how the infection control team grew from the original three people to include the entire staff. This first story illustrates that when invited, frontline staff generate solutions. The invitation and the fact that it's their solution compel them to act their way to a new way of thinking, rather than trying to think their way to a new way of acting. This is a fundamental principle of positive deviance. In this slide, a group who volunteered to help out is meeting to go over the product of these conversations. The facilitators or coaches of this process listened to over 800 staff in an acute care and a long-term care facility at the VA in Pittsburgh. They documented the outcomes of these conversations, and this is a core group of people reviewing what the outcome was. It includes a doctor, a pharmacy tech, two nurses, a nurse's aide, a physician's assistant, and a room cleaner. They are reviewing the responses gathered from our discussions, writing actionable opportunities down on Post-it notes, and then literally wallpapering the room with Post-its. David, the guy in the yellow or in the blue scrub suit with his hands up, is a nurse's aide. This is sort of a Kodak moment. He's actually saying, and I remember this vividly, this is gold. These are our solutions. Let's do it. I had never seen this kind of passionate reaction, this deep sense of group ownership coming from the staff. Well, that's story number one. Let's go to the next slide. This shows the room cleaners. We had uncovered some, we'd uncovered actually three transmissions in the same room over a six-week period, and that raised the issue of room cleaning. A lot of the housekeepers had volunteered from our original community meeting, and they attended one of our Discovery in Action dialogues when this issue was brought up. And they said, well, you know, we'd like to know where these germs are growing in the rooms that we're cleaning. So the IP did some environmental culturing and provided this illustration with all the green dots, shows where MRSA was, where the cultures were positive for MRSA. This also led to bedside nurses and nurses' aides who take vital signs and use shared equipment in isolation rooms to realize that the blood pressure cuff that they were moving from room to room, this was back in 2005, might be a vector for transmission. They discovered actually a warehouse full of VA equipment, including a bunch of disposable blood pressure cuffs. And you can see on this slide number 36, the shared equipment, which they then designed for the isolation rooms. There's a place for a tourniquet for blood draws. There's a pink stethoscope. This is a surgical floor, and they knew that no surgeon would be caught dead with a pink stethoscope, so that stays there, and then a disposable blood pressure cuff. The next slide shows a patient transport technician. This is where the staff actually came up with countermeasures that were not covered by SHEA, HCPAC, or APIC guidelines. How do you get a patient? What precautions are required in taking a patient from an isolation room to a support service like X-ray or the operating room? And this shows one of our technicians, patient transport technicians, and one of the solutions that he came up with on his own. It shows the patient all bundled up, a supply bag filled with a gown, gloves, and a little bottle of Purell, so that the signal that this patient requires special precautions. He would then call the receiving unit that notified them that the patient was coming and required special precautions and arrived with the supplies that they needed. This is an elegant solution that, in terms of ownership, I don't think anything that we had tried before, including the Toyota production system, could possibly have come up with. The next slide shows one of the unlikely suspects. Actually, all of the pastoral caregivers in the hospital volunteered to work on this, and we were quite surprised because they were the most adherent to precautions. They were dutifully washing their hands, but they didn't know, and they were putting on gowns and gloves and going into an isolation room, but they didn't know what MRSA was. That was their first question. What is MRSA? And when they found out that it was transmitted by touch, they said, oh my gosh, we may be transmitting more than the good word. We take our Bibles from room to room. They came up with an innovative solution by putting paper, disposable paper hats, little essentially gowns around their Bibles when they would go in with their own gowns and gloves into an isolation room and then discard it with their other PPEs. Seems like a trivial solution, but when you consider that there were now hundreds of frontline staff coming up with literally thousands of these small penny solutions, it's not surprising that it would have some kind of impact, which I'll show you in just a minute. This is what the housekeepers did with their slide showing the environmental culturing results. They sat down with the IP with pictures of a room and a bathroom. They put black dots on everything they clean on a daily basis and red dots for things they clean in addition when the room is turned over. She had dusted the room with germ glow without telling them. They put it to the test. She turned the lights off, turned the UV light on. They went back to the drawing board, refined this. And then they took this end product back to their monthly meeting, showed it to their colleagues. They refined it. They were so proud of this solution that they laminated this and put it on their carts. They complained that the policy manual for room cleaning was out of date. It had no illustrations. It was all text. And this is what they're using today. It's on every cleaning cart and in every supply closet. And there's no question about who owns this solution. So what PD tells us, this is the next slide, is that solutions imported from the outside result in sort of a social immune reaction, the same way that bodies reject foreign bodies. It elicits the yeah, but syndrome. Yeah, but they're not us. Yeah, but we're not them. Yeah, but we're different. The best practices imported from the outside are not nearly as durable or scalable as local best practices discovered from the inside. PD really is an inside job. Next slide just outlines the difference between buy-in and ownership. Buy-in, of course, is when somebody from up the chain, up in the organization chart, comes up with an idea, or an outside consultant brings in a best practice and then asks the staff to implement it. Ownership is exactly the opposite. This is where the frontline staff develops the idea, makes the decisions, designs the action plan, and acts on it. The next slide shows the performance parameters that the frontline staff wanted to use in determining the impact of the countermeasures that they were coming up with. And it includes the NARI swabbing rate on admission and discharge, and adherence to standard and contact precautions. And this was kept on every unit. They eventually mainly concentrated on, once they got up to about 90% NARI swabbing rates in and out, they really were looking at transmission rates and infection rates. If there was a transmission or a flurry of them, then they would begin to do some more observations on compliance with standard and contact precautions. This next slide shows what's different here. You can reflect on that at your leisure if you would like. I'm not going to spend any time because we've only got about 10 minutes left, so let's get to the results. This shows the results of healthcare-acquired MRSA infections at the Pittsburgh VA starting the year prior to the PD intervention, showing you the infection rates per 1,000 patient and per 1,000 patient bed days of care. That's the way the VA measures their results. And you can see with a little bit of noise in 07 that there's been a relentless decline in MRSA infections at the Pittsburgh VA ever since this was initiated. I just called one of the people that was involved on the surgical unit to get an update on the results. And as of today, the surgical unit has gone 1,043 days and with only 3 surgical site infections. Prior to this, they were generating 3 surgical site infections a month. Surgical site infection is an infection that occurs in the hospital or within 30 days after the patient is discharged, according to the CDC guideline. It wasn't only MRSA that responded to PD. The enhanced mindfulness of the frontline staff about infection prevention precautions also had an impact on other resistant pathogens, which also yielded to the same approach. You can see that VRE, ESBL, and C. diff also showed significant decreases. There's a little blip in VRE from 07 to 08, and Dr. Jane informs me that as of January of this year, that has come back down and continues to decline. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Pioneer Portfolio Group got wind of what was happening at the VA and invited a grant proposal, which they approved. This enabled five other hospitals in addition to the VA, including Hopkins and Franklin Square in Baltimore, University of Louisville, Albert Einstein in Philadelphia, and Billings Clinic in Montana, to apply the same PD process to MRSA prevention. This grant started in 06 and ended in 08. These hospitals are still communicating with each other every other week. This is a picture of John Jernigan, who, after the results of this Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant that was administered by the Plexus Institute, showed dramatic sustained reductions over this period of time in the participating sites. As national rates were going up, the PD beta site infection rates were going down. This shows, this next slide is a graphic that shows these hospitals. I've already shown you the VA data, but this shows that each of these hospitals started doing active surveillance and applying PD in a high-risk unit. Most of the time it was in an intensive care unit, and then they went from one unit to many. This first slide shows you the dramatic reductions in MRSA infections in those target units. And then by the end of the grant period in 2008, most of the hospitals had gone house-wide, and these are their house-wide MRSA infection rates. We had a sister hospital in Bogota, Colombia. They, after a couple of trips that the Sternens and several of us made, they adopted the PD approach to their MRSA infections, and you can see the relentless decrease in MRSA infections over time as a result of their work. Earlier this year, the CDC presented the results of the beta sites. You can look at this at your leisure. The bottom line is that the beta sites that submitted the data showed sustained reductions in MRSA infections. It might also add that the antibiogram in these hospitals also showed a decline in resistance of Staph aureus to methicillin from 10 to 20%. So it not only affected the culture of the healthcare workers, but it affected the resistant the culture of the pathogens. This shows social network analysis, which is a qualitative measure that we used at the VA. In 2005, when we started, these are four units that were asked, where the staff was asked, whom are you working with on MRSA prevention? The cluster in the middle, this is the infection control team, and you can see that most of the communicating is from the staff to the unit manager, and then from unit manager to the infection control team. When we asked the question at our kickoff in 2005 with the hospital employees represented, we said, who's responsible for preventing these infections? And they pointed to three people, the two IP nurses and the hospital epidemiologist. In 2007, a year into this process, after they had reduced MRSA infection rates by 50%, the same questions were asked, and now you can see rich communicating within and between units. Actually, two of the units are in the acute care and two are in the long-term care facility. You can see the gradual disappearance of the central importance of the infection control team, and now we have a sort of a giant infection control team. At that point, we had a celebration to celebrate the 50% reduction, and about the same amount of people came to it. They were asked who's responsible for preventing these infections, and essentially every hand went up. So two slides now. The Positive Deviants partnership now includes the six beta sites that were supported by RWJ. The Agency for Health Research and Quality is currently supporting seven other hospitals to integrate PD with Lean. This includes a hospital in Canada, and that hospital, University Health Network in Toronto, has then spread this to six other Canadian hospitals. The Rockefeller Foundation is funding a global expansion of PD, part of which is this work on MRSA. The next slide shows the PD essentials, which you can review at your leisure. I would only emphasize that we have been a fairly non-adaptive industry among industries in healthcare. Some would say that we've been belligerently non-adaptable. PD and other asset-based approaches are beginning to enable healthcare workers to adapt to the complexity of their work. It's no longer acceptable. Those who have had experience with this, the frontline staff, they are very serious about this. They and the patients they care for believe that one healthcare acquired infection is too many. Their goal is to get to zero, and the closer they get to it, the more they realize that they can accomplish it. So there's a movement afoot among frontline staff who are beginning to see these dramatic reductions to pursue the theoretical limit of performance, which would be zero healthcare acquired infections. Finally, this I think this quote by Robert Frost really captures what we saw. We, the middle management and senior leaders in hospitals, dance around in a ring and suppose, while the secret sits in the middle and knows. Last slide, just to remind you that the solutions are frequently right in front of our face, and there's a way of uncovering them. And I'd like to acknowledge the enormous efforts of the people listed on this last slide. I guess we've got a couple of minutes, but I'll turn the time over to you, Paul.
Dr. Lloyd, thank you very much for that. It was very interesting. It's a fascinating program. One of the things that must be tremendously frustrating is that the solutions that work in one place are often not transferable to another place, that the solutions have to be created at each hospital, basically. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, there is value in reinventing the wheel to foster ownership. PD in West Africa, in translation, is called the faraway stick doesn't kill the nearby snake. So, this isn't about importing solutions from one successful hospital to the next. It's about fostering a framework in which the solutions that already exist can be found and amplified within the same hospital.
Now, tell me about the work that you're doing expanding PD into the mental health community.
Well, a couple of years ago, a study reported a 25-year disparity in longevity that affects people with serious mental illness, severe depression, bipolar, and schizophrenia. The National Alliance for Mental Illness, NAMI, has decided to pilot PD to investigate the cause of this disparity and to go to those who face this problem every day, those with serious mental illness, to uncover the positive deviance among them and to tap into their secrets and focus on a high-risk area here in southwestern Pennsylvania. And we're actually training people with serious mental illness to facilitate these discovery and action dialogues. They're going to drop-in centers at two sites in one small geographic area and asking the powerful questions that will define current practice, will also identify the positive deviance among them and the specific behaviors and strategies they do or that they use to avoid isolation. We're finding that diversity of socialization is one of the hallmarks of recovery from mental illness. And by recovery, I mean living a full life in terms of years and quality with your mental illness and caring about your physical health and taking care of that so that there is a sense of responsibility and interest in integrating one's mental and physical health care. We're only about a year into this, but I think that it's showing the same kind of promise that our initial experience with healthcare acquired infections shows.
Well, that's outstanding. It must be very exciting to be doing some new work like that and seeing the results that you're seeing. Thank you again very much for making this time for us. Thank you to all of you for joining us today. And Dr. Lloyd, thank you again. I love the concept of positive deviance, and from what I've heard of it, it really is changing lives, and I thank you for being a part of that.
Thank you very much. It's been a privilege to participate.
We'll talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.